You're listening to Does God Love War? A dialogue between Chris Hedges and Hamza Yusuf. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. We continue with Does God Love War? Right.
Guantanamizing your enemy. They have no rights. They're not human. They're terrorists. And terrorists are evil. And we're good, and therefore, by eliminating evil, we're doing something that is good. This is the justification. If you're not with us, you're with the terrorists, which was an attempt at paraphrasing Christ, who made a spiritual statement, he who's not with me is against me, which is a spiritual statement. But unfortunately, and this is a problem, I know that God once did speak through a bush, but we have a president who's misunderstanding that was a burning bush. That wasn't a burnt bush, right? That was a burning bush. You know, and that's the problem with this country, is that we're not setting our sights high enough, really. We're not aiming high enough as a people. And when you don't aim high enough, you either shoot yourself in the foot or you shoot your friend. That's a big problem that we've got in this country. You know, it's time that we really started setting our sights a little higher, because the foundational principles of this civilization are very high ones. And although, unfortunately, there were atrocities and there's terrible things that occurred at the hands of the early people in this country, but again, we did not inherit their evils, but we have benefited from their good. And it's very dangerous to demonize people because of some of their actions and not recognizing all of their actions. Because all of us are an admixture of good and evil. And in the melodramatic world of cartoons, where good is good and evil is evil, that was the cartoons I grew up. Now they're quite different. Superman lives in a parallel universe, and there's a negative Superman, so there's a whole lot of the thing children are getting. But when I was growing up, and that was the time, you know, a little before me, George was growing up as well. And so, we were given cartoons where things were clear. Things were black and white. Good people wore white hats, and bad people wore black hats, which is problematic for the Iranian mullahs, right? I mean, they really fit the bill, don't they? You know? I was actually just with Ayatollah Khatami in Qatar. He was at the UN. He has a PhD from Germany in German philosophy. Right? I mean, you know, people assume he's kind of a, you know, some kind of medieval throwback. I mean, the man is really far more sophisticated than a lot of rulers that we've had in the West. You know, so. So this pseudo-speciation is what happens in the melodramatic universe. Now, what's interesting is we have a biological problem, because if you look at children, at about 7 months, a child, after an intense bonding with the mother, actually begins to recognize strangers and often will be frightened of them. They'll sometimes actually look and cry. And it happens to good people. It's not always... don't assume they're seeing something that you're not. Although they might be, don't assume they're not. But this is what they do. They begin to recognize something that is foreign or alien. The family is the first in-group that we have. The family is our in-group. What's outside of the family is an out-group. When you go to school, you also have in-groups and out-groups. Our society thrives on this idea. As I was driving here, I was passing by these Phi Beta Kappa and, you know, these sororities and fraternities around Berkeley, which is a classic in-group, out-group phenomenon. When you join a fraternity, there's a hazing. You have to get really drunk. I mean, they kill them sometimes, these poor people. Really, in hazing, people die in that initiation, that rite of passage. But you bond. Do you know, like George was in the Skull and Bones Club. And they have very intense bonding. They actually, you know, apparently have to go and dig up a dead person and spend a night in a coffin with a dead person. I don't know if those things are true, but people write about them like that. And it's very odd. But I don't think it should shock you if you've just seen, you know, the type of things that people are capable of doing. I mean, Chris talked about necrophilia. Lions don't do that. You know, monkeys don't do that. Humans do that. Right, really, we're capable of just immense depravity. But these in-groups and out-groups, this is the essence of war. Now, if you look at what is the foundation of war, where does it come from? There's people that, again, say, you know, men don't like war, women don't like war. There's actually whole social theories that refute conflict theory, that war is thrust upon people. I don't believe that. We have a society that relishes war. Patton said anybody that says Americans don't like a war is a liar. Americans love a good war. I mean, that's General Patton. Now, he liked war, obviously. I mean, it was a passion with him. Really very intelligent man. I actually read his notes from World War II. It's called Our War. And on the very first entry, he just arrived at North Africa, and he said, just finished the Quran. He ended the entry by saying, just finished reading the Quran. A good book, very interesting. You just wonder about the generals nowadays. But he was going to a Muslim country. He wanted to work out what they were about. So you read a foundational book. If you want to understand America, I don't know what you would read. You know, I don't. I think you'd probably have to see a Quentin Tarantino film. Right? To really, or go to, you know, big time wrestling. Right? Go to one. I wonder where all those people come from in those big giant auditoriums. Are they walking around out here? Are they in the grocery stores with us? You know, you just have to want. I mean, if you want to inculcate peace, it's a very odd thing by teaching young children. You know, having these two. Wrestling used to be a noble thing. You know, two people and they wrestled, and then they shook hands afterwards. They don't do that anymore. You know, they hit each other over the head with boards and smash their heads up again. It's supposed to be fake, but kids can't determine that. And we had one poor 13-year-old boy jumped on this 5-year-old kid and killed him, shattered his spleen. And he got it from big-time wrestling. You know, that's why they have these big don't do this at home. And the only reason I know about big-time wrestling, it's very popular in Saudi Arabia. They actually really like big-time wrestling. And they're convinced it's real. I was once in a qahwa place, coffee house, and they were watching it. And I said, that's not real. And they said, no, it's real. Look. I gave up, you know. I mean, how do you argue with him? Look, he threw him down. He fell down. It's real. But promoting that type of a culture, because I really believe Abu Ghraib is a direct result. I call these guys Quentin Tarantino's children. They're kids that grew up on violence, on pornography. Garbage in, garbage out. And I really was hoping for one, it was a bit of optimism on my part, but I was actually hoping that perhaps our country would just for a brief moment be able to recognize our shadow, just to see an aspect of our culture, of who we are. Because we are Abu Ghraib. That is part of us. And to deny that, to say it has nothing to do with the United States of America, is to deny our shadow. And Jung believed that the more you denied the shadow, the greater it grew. The greater it grew. Unless you were able, he felt it was like a seesaw, that your you know, the beautiful aspect of the human soul had to be in balance with the shadow. And if it wasn't, if you denied it, you elevated it. And what we do in war is we project our shadow onto others. This is what we do. All the despicable qualities that we hate about ourselves, we project them on the other. Do you see? The Arabs, you know, hate women. They're misogynistic. Look at some of the statistics in our own country. Pornography is the number one media industry in the United States of America. What does that tell us about our culture and how we view women? The Arabs that I know, they love women. Really. And I don't say that, you can interpret that as you like, but there's those type of Arabs as well. But every Arab learns from the time they're little children, al-jannatu tahta aqdam al-ummahat. Paradise is at the feet of the mother. That's what the Prophet Muhammad taught his community, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Paradise is at the feet of the mother. I know Arabs that would never greet their mother without kissing her hand and kissing her forehead. Would do anything for their mothers, really. So we can project all of that darkness onto the other, and it enables us to demonize them, to treat them despicably, to carpet bomb them, to brutalize them, and things that Chris talked about in his talk that he's seen. I mean, I saw some of it in the refugee camps in Peshawar during the Afghani war against the Russians. Just the faces of the people. I mean, that's what happens when you demonize the other. It's just very easy to degrade, cover them in feces, violate them with sticks. I mean, this is what people can do. And what's interesting to me about war and religion, because it's a paradox, religion, of all the religions, Islam is most associated with militancy. It's seen as a militant religion. And there's certainly a militant aspect about Islam. Muslims are people. Solzhenitsyn said when he was in the Gulag in Siberia, and he wrote this. It's a very beautiful passage in one of his books. He said, of all the people in the Gulag, the one people that refused to be subjugated by the Russian guards were the Chechens. They would not submit to the humiliation. They always stood up and they would fight. And he said, and the unusual thing about this is that they actually gained the respect of the Russian guards. And the Russian guards had a type of fear of them. Chechnyans, the name for their capital, Grozny, is fierce. Tolstoy wrote a book about a Chechnyan mujahid called Haji Murad, about the nobility of the Chechnyan warrior. Chechnyans are a very free and independent people. And one of the things that Islam teaches is never to be a slave of anybody but God. Never bow down to anybody. Honor people, respect people, but never allow a person to abuse you. That's at the essence of the Islamic teaching, because you have been ennobled by God, according to the Quran. All of the children of Adam and Eve have been ennobled by God. We have a human dignity that is essential to our nature, our character. And in honoring that dignity, we must honor others. And in honoring that dignity, we do not allow ourselves to be dishonored. And the Prophet Muhammad said, a believer does not humiliate him or herself. So that's something very essential. And that's why the Palestinians are a resistant people. It's difficult for them. And even if they lash out in heinous ways, if you don't understand what is the essence of that, then you're missing the point. You're missing the point. Because while I condemn the use of indiscriminate violence, I'm completely opposed to it, and I believe that blowing up buses in Tel Aviv is indiscriminate violence. I don't agree with it. I've always been against it. I've read arguments for it by certain scholars from the Middle East. I've never been convinced by them. But it happens. And the question that I think we're confronted with, Dostoevsky said it's very easy to hate those who do evil, but it's very difficult to understand them. And this is one of the great things about the poets and why we need the poets. Alden, September 1939, he was sitting in a dive in New York City when he heard about the invasion of Poland. And he said that scholarship could explain what was unleashed. He said, ask what happened at Linz. What unleashed that imago? A psychopathic god. I in the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. And that's a lesson that we need to learn. We need to learn that what we are seeing is a projection of ourselves. It's a projection of ourselves. And we all need to see this on all sides. Because as long as we pseudo-speciate, as long as we deem the other as less than human, the kafir, right, the disbeliever, the infidel, justifying with that abuse of that other, then we've failed to learn the essential truths of our tradition, whatever it might be. Because at the root of war is injustice, it's greed, it's selfishness, and it's a total lack of concern for the suffering of others. And all of those things, religions came to free us from. And that's absolute truth. Whether it's Hinduism, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, they came to expose to us the worst qualities, our shadow, so that we might know ourselves better. And until we have greater self-knowledge, and this is what we're confronted with, an absolute imperative to have self-knowledge, because that's what this is about. It's about learning about ourselves through the lens of the other. Imam Shafi'i, one of the great scholars of Islam, was once asked, how did you get such excellent character? He said, I always listened to what my enemies said about me, and I took it seriously. Our enemies have something to teach us. In Latin, the word enemy comes from inimicus, not friend, somebody who's not a friend, which in the pre-modern world, that's the way it was viewed. The tribe and everybody else. There's a tribe in the Amazon called the Wari tribe, W-A-R-I. And their word, according to a linguist, Stephen Pinter, their word for dinner or for food is not a Wari. Which he said was problematic if you were ever invited to have dinner with them. Being unwary. But that is the pre-modern world, the tribe. Do you see the tribe? It's me versus them. The Arabs have a proverb, me and my brother against my cousin, me, my brother, and my cousin against my neighbor, and me, my brother, my cousin, and my neighbor against everyone else. I mean, that's one view of the world. That's a view that our religions came to remove. Tribalism, provincialism, partisanship. Nationalism is a disease. It's a disease. And I don't believe patriotism is a disease. Love of your country is not a negative thing. It's a good thing. People always say, my country, right or wrong, but they forget the actual quote of the admiral that made that. He's a brilliant, I mean, extraordinary man. He was an early warrior was in the War of Tripoli. Decatur. I think we have Decatur, Illinois, Georgia. They're named after him, Stephen Decatur. Or Decatur, I don't know how they say that. But in his famous toast, he actually said, our country, may she always be right. May she always be right in her foreign affairs. But our country, right or wrong. Very different to my country, right or wrong. When our country is in the wrong, we need to stand by the truth. That is not tribalism. That is patriotism. Because that comes from love. It doesn't come from hate. It comes from love of your country. And that's why we're living in a time when dissent has become, once again, a dangerous word. A dangerous word. If you ask me, does God love war? I would have to say, I don't believe God loves war. War in the Quran is used 4 times, the word. It's a negative word in the Quran, harb. There are 2 times in which war is declared by God on people. When they engage in usury, which is considered an economic injustice, it's prohibited in the Torah, it was prohibited in church canon law, and Aristotle said it was the most unnatural form of money or wealth acquisition, condemned by all the ancient philosophers. And much of what we're witnessing around this globe is directly due to immense debt in these countries all around the globe that are paying exorbitant, usurious returns to industrialized countries that have lent them money, designed. Read Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Really, read that book. It's an important book about what we do and where that resentment comes, just trying to understand it at a deeper level. That's what we need to do. But God, according to the Quran, the Quranic narrative, there's a verse, إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُحِبُّ الْمُعْتَدِينَ. God does not love those who aggress. And there are 2 types of war. There is a war of aggression and there's a war of defense. And all of our religious traditions give people the right to defend themselves, whether it's Christianity with its just law theory, St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, believe that it was absolutely congruent with the teachings of Christianity, the right to self-defense, watching what they call the double effect, which is very stringent criteria for when good can cause evil. So collateral damage, carpet bombing, all these things. I mean, bombing people from the air. That's one of the things we have, a mechanism in ourselves that protects us from inflicting people with pain. It's called sympathy, compassion, pity. I mean, these are very powerful emotions that we acquire early on, usually given to us by our mothers. And when you distance, when you use weapons, where you drop bombs from 30,000 feet, there's no room for those inhibitors. There's no room for those constraints. So it becomes pushing a button. We don't see the results of what that button does. One of the things about and why books like The Unembedded are so important, and we honor Kale and people like her that are trying to bring these images to people. One of the reasons why they're so important is to see that true side of war, what it does to people, the effects it has on just the common people. One of the things that General William Westmoreland, who was back in the old days in Berkeley, he was called Waste More Land. He was one of the Vietnam generals. But General Westmoreland, who I think is famous for saying we had to destroy the village to save it, but he said Vietnam was the first uncensored war. And when you don't censor war, it creates confusion in the public mind. What type of confusion? Because that's very Orwellian. What it creates in the public mind is moral conscience. An understanding that what we're doing is morally wrong. It's repugnant. And that is what we have to take it out. I really believe, and I think we should be inspired by the abolitionist movement, which began in the late 18th century by 12 people in a small house in London. That house is still there. It's honored. When they began that, never did they believe in their wildest dreams that they would end slavery in their lifetimes. But they saw it. By 1732, the British had outlawed. By 1832, the British had outlawed the slave trade. It took some time to stop it. But they did it, and it was done by a handful of men and women committed to that, mostly working, in fact, really entirely working from the best of the Christian tradition. The best of the Christian tradition. And that movement took off. It was a great movement in the 19th century in this country. And I really believe that it's people like that that need to emerge from among us, that are really willing to recognize that we are facing a choice between consciousness and catastrophe. If we don't wake up, we're on a perilous path to our own destruction. And we are the first generation, as it's been said many times, that has in its hands the capacity to destroy itself, our species. War is still a major threat. People are suffering from it all around the world. Nuclear proliferation is a major threat. Pakistan and India, disaster. Really, it's a disaster. Failed states. We have a lot of work to do. I really hope that people will take that home with them. And I hope we can have some more discussion and conversation. And I really, Chris Hedges, I read his book when it first came out, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. I really recommend to all of you that you read that book. It's an important book because in the absence of meaning, war is certainly one substitute. And our country right now is suffering from a vacuum of meaning and purpose. Consumerism just doesn't do the trick. You know, no matter how many trips to Walmart you make, those products never do what they say they're supposed to do. They just don't. It looks good in the store, and you get it home, and it's just seems so different when I first saw it. You know, and before you know it, it's in some corner of the house, right? And then it's in the garage sale. So consumerism doesn't do the trick. And if you replace the sacred, it's always empty things that you try to fill that void with. God bless all of you. Thank you very much.
One of the things, and both of you talked about war a lot, but I noticed not quite enough about religion, so I'm going to try and bring up some religious issues about religion. Chris Hedges, I know you're working on a project right now that has to do with the religious right, and can share that with the audience. Can you talk a little bit about what part of the religious right, what you're focused on?
Well, I want to preface that by saying that I grew up in the church. My father was a Presbyterian minister. My mother graduated from seminary and was a professor. I graduated with a Master of Divinity from Harvard Divinity School, which is the degree you get if you are going to be a preacher. I was not ordained, but I did the academic work. So that's the orientation I come from. Of course, as you know, I spent about two decades abroad and spent much of that time in disintegrating states, covering countries where extremist movements, one thinks of, for instance, the nationalist movements in the former Yugoslavia, appropriated religion. There was nothing religious about Slobodan Milosevic, but he certainly knew how to manipulate the language and the iconography of the Serbian Orthodox Church, as well as bring much of the leadership of the Serbian Orthodox Church into his campaign of genocide that was carried out in Bosnia and, of course, then later Kosovo. So, having spent a lot of time around people who claimed to speak in the name of God for activities that I felt and I think knew, certainly understood, were antithetical to their own religious tradition as well as my own, coming back to the United States and listening to the language of the Pat Robertsons and the Falwells and the Dobsons, I found deep similarities between their ideology of hatred and exclusion and bigotry and self-righteousness and language of violence. The belief that those who did not embrace their peculiar brand of Christianity were agents of Satan. They were demonic forces. This triggered a great deal, frankly, of anger within me as somebody who is a Christian and certainly informed very deeply by my own religious tradition, that somehow my struggle and stand before God was worthless because it didn't conform to their particular vision. I think that that kind of language is poisonous, dangerous in a civil society because it creates an exclusive group which empowers itself at the expense of all others. And I have seen such groups at work in the Middle East, in the Balkans, in Latin America, in Asia, and it's those similarities that frightened me. I think you spoke about patriotism. It's certainly a love of my country and a love of my religion that has led me to write a book that is not a history of the Christian right, but very much an assault against the Christian right. I'm not willing to give people who preach hate religious legitimacy, even if they claim to speak on behalf of my religion.
Hamza Yusuf, I want to follow up on that. If this idea of the religious right, we have similar parallels in other
right.
religions around the world.
Well, religion is not supposed to be right or left. It's supposed to be straight.
Right, but you know we have that strain everywhere, that sort of fundamentalism, if you want to call it that. But I wonder if you talk about why it is so appealing. Why is it so popular? People accept that?
I mean, part of what's happening is religion is still reacting to modernity. Modernity, the Vatican, I think their definition is a good one. They defined modernity as the privatization of religion, what Stephen Carter calls God as a hobby. What you're seeing is a reaction still. The Muslims are definitely reacting to modernity because in the Muslim world, as you know, I mean, you've been there, religion is just, you know, there's a call to prayer five times a day. It wakes you up at Fajr, at dawn. And so religion still deeply informs people's lives. Arabs, even secularized Arabs, are constantly using religious formula in their language that have really disappeared from the English language. I mean, we used to use a lot, like Godspeed was a very common term. You know, God be with you. Goodbye is actually a contraction of God be with you. But people used to use these. God willing was used. The Spanish say ojalá, which is from inshallah. You know, inshallah, God willing, and that's what it's supposed to mean. Now it means maybe. Right. You know, it's still deeply informed by religion, and there's three religious responses to modernity. One is assimilation, another is withdrawal, and the fourth is confrontation. And so we're seeing a confrontation going on now, and we're in a period of what you know sociologists call anomy, where things the carpet's been pulled out from under people, and we don't really have a ground for morals anymore. For really, mm-hmm. We're just seeing a lot of major changes in society, and religion, which is often informed by pre-modern concepts of morality, which are still very important to many religious people, they're really groping with what's going on. So, you know, some of it is growing pains because there's things we need to abandon from the past. But others are genuine conflictual experience inside.
But there's a reason why your brand of Islam, what you talk about, is appealing to people, but also is Osama bin Laden's brand, what he talks about,
right.
Islam. That's very appealing to a lot of people around the world. I'm trying to understand why
Bin Laden, to me, is it's like a Spartacus character. It's the rebellion of the slaves. And so there's a lot of people that see, that's what they see, like a Palestinian in Khan Yunis, you know, who's grown up all his life in just utterly unbelievable conditions. And they feel a lot of resentment. So when somebody strikes back, you know, if you actually personalize the suffering, they're against it, you know, but mm-hmm. it's more symbolic. And that's something that's very easy to do when things are distant, when you watch them on television. You know, there's people that can watch a news thing on Rwanda and turn off the television and go eat dinner. Or they'll eat dinner while they're watching it, you know. So this is the ability for humans just to shut things off inside, and I think that's what happens to people. But I really believe that Islam is in crisis, the Muslims are in crisis, and we need, I think, a new discourse. There's a discourse that was borrowed largely from the Marxists, and it was Islamicized, you know, and Marxism is rooted, in my estimation, much of it is rooted in resentment. And some of that resentment is obviously valid, but resentment is not a rung on the spiritual ladder.
You're quite passionate about your dislike, if I might call it that, of the religious right, of the you know, and I'm just curious whether that's something that you feel is really, obviously you feel it's dangerous, but what exactly is the threat that they pose? You talk about language they use and all that, but what is the threat that they pose?
I think the religious right, you know, what it's done, if you look closely, is appropriated the language of evangelical Christians, as well as, of course, the language of American patriotism. But they have really changed, or they have taken over the institutions and shunted aside those people within evangelical institutions who don't buy into this concept that they have a right to create a Christian America. I all urge you to look at Jimmy Carter's book. You know, he does a pretty good job of this. Jimmy Carter, himself being an evangelical, who, when the Southern Baptist Convention was taken over by these so-called Christian Reconstructionists, these people who wanted to organize and create a drive for political power, when all those evangelicals who didn't buy into this were ruthlessly shunted aside, and you can go back and read about the purges that took place in the Southern Baptist Convention in 1980 to see this. And so what we're seeing is a kind of cannibalization. I mean, I don't come out of the evangelical tradition. I'm a Presbyterian, and I come out of the sort of liberal wing of the Presbyterian Church. But these people are not evangelicals, although they look like evangelicals. And I think that that's important to remember, that these people who have appropriated these issues that many people care about, these value issues, appropriated the language. And I think the other important point to remember, I think you've spoken very eloquently about this, is that we do live with a kind of moral rot. I mean, and sometimes there are most prescient social critics. I think what they offer as a solution is far worse. But they're not always wrong about understanding the problem. But I just want to say one more thing. I think that the big draw is that we have created in modern society all sorts of forms to destroy the human community. So that these people are very lonely and very isolated. You know, the biggest growth of this movement is in the exurbs. Why? Because there's no community center, there's no connection with their neighbor, they live in these big empty houses with palladium windows, they get in these big empty cars, they drive to these big soulless offices, and they go home. And I think as writers like Karl Popper and Hannah Arendt have understood well, Hannah Arendt calls it atomization, right. But it's that solitude, that loneliness, that despair, ultimately, that is the essential element that creates totalitarian movements. This is a movement that, you know, all you have to do is turn on the 700 Club or TBN or, you know, listen to Benny Hinn or any of these people who reach tens of millions of Americans within their households in a parallel information system network by which these people never have to hear reality-based news at all. And listen to the language they use about us.
Is there reality-based news? I'm just curious.
I think there is.
No, you're New York Times.
There is reality-based news, and it's you don't see it much anymore on television. But there is such a thing as going out and reporting a story, and a belief that other viewpoints are important, that there isn't, you know, that not everything that you report about has to conform to a law of history that leads to Armageddon, and you know, and much of the attack on the public school system and the effort to promote the teaching of creationism and the attack ultimately on the reality-based news media. I mean, they hate the New York Times. And I was just in a, I'm sure we can all critique the New York Times, but I was just in a seminar in Missouri where they were teaching teachers how to teach creationism. And in the middle of it, they went off on a diatribe against the Times. I'm sure I was the only Times reader in the room. But what they were doing was the same thing they were doing by creationism. They were trying to create, this is a system that believes in magic. It's in superstition and signs and wonders. It's not a reality-based system. And all reality-based systems, like science, for instance, you know, honest, dispassionate, intellectual inquiry, and news reporting that is not, that doesn't carry a particular, is a threat to them. And so they are trying to destroy those institutions. And it is not a matter of wanting their voices heard. It's a matter of wanting that, those reality-based systems to be eradicated.
But some people believe that, that's what they're leading to is kind of borderism being fascism. Do you think this is fascism in some form?
I think
that
this, I
the
think
thinking, the mentality is a fascist mentality.
I think if you take the main pillars of fascist ideology, yes, I think that they are America's fascists.
And Hamza Yusuf, do you think there are similar fascist leanings in other religions, in Islam and Hinduism?
Well, there's definitely, you know, whenever a person who's informed by faith arrogates to themselves God's voice, that's the most dangerous type of religion. One of the beauties of Islam that I love is that any scholar that ever gave a fatwa, they would always end the fatwa by saying, and God knows best. You know, in other words, this is the best that I can do at understanding this issue, but I'm human, I'm fallible. And God speaks through language for people that believe in revelation, and language is symbols, and symbols are open to more than one interpretation. Literalist tradition in religion historically is not the majority of religion. It's always very small sects within religion, but unfortunately, it is becoming a much larger movement than it ever was. I mean, the Catholics are not literalists. They've never been literalists. The predominant Muslim tradition, both Shia and Sunni, is not literalist tradition. I mean, there are things that are taken literally, right, you know, because language is language, and something, if it means something, it means something, just like law. The law is what's stated. But much of the tradition is open to multiple interpretation, and, you know, the rabbis say if you get three rabbis, you get four opinions. That there's a lot of truth in Islam like that, you know, that you really, and Islam is closer to rabbinical Judaism in that it really does have a very fluid interpretive community. I mean, I was just on a Danish television program, and they brought up this person, and he said, there's no such thing as extremist Islam or moderate Islam. There's only Islam, and you're either Muslim or you're not. In other words, you're either following my definition of Islam or you're not a Muslim. That's what he was really saying. And, you know, my response to that was, my Islam encompasses his voice. I mean, I'm not going to negate that he's a co-religionist. But his Islam does not encompass me. You know, he's drawn a very narrow circle and defined that as Islam. My circle is much broader. And I think religion, by its nature, if it is not inclusive, it's dangerous. And these voices that want to arrogate for themselves the voice of God and tell us what God is saying without any ambiguity, I don't believe that. Because, you know, it's very interesting that in the Islamic tradition, before you can comment on the Quran, you have to master Jahili poetry, which is pre-Islamic poetry. It's actually a prerequisite before you can interpret the Quran. And part of the reason is that poetry precedes revelation. All great revelation is preceded by poetry. And in fact, you know, this is in the Hindu tradition, in the Islamic, even, you know, if you consider Plato or Socrates, at least, from some kind of prophetic tradition, which many Muslim scholars did, there is no Socrates without Homer. I mean, Homer is, he is the basis for Socratic thought. And the beauty of poets is they're never melodramatic. I mean, if you look at Homer, and, you know, William Blake thought, we're never going to get rid of war until we change the foundational book of Western civilization. He thought you had to get rid of the Iliad. But the Iliad could be read as a really anti-war testimony. And the thing about Homer that I love is Homer's a Greek, but he never lets you know whether he's really on the Trojan side or the Greek side. He won't do that. He won't fall into that trap. Yeah. And he presents the nobility of the Trojans, and he presents the nobility of the Greeks, and he presents, you know, he's actually, I think, a little harsher on the Greeks, you know, if anything. Menelaus, I mean, there's people in there that just don't come out looking very well. Whereas Hector, you know, he looks a lot better than the Greek leader. So I think when you teach poetry, and I really believe that that's what we have to reintroduce into these curricula, I think poetry is an antidote for fascism. I think it's an antidote for fanaticism.
On the issue of literalism, certainly among, you know, the Christian literalists, is that they're not actually literalists. They're selective literalists. Having studied the Bible, they clearly pick out what is useful to them and ignore the rest. There are many things in the Bible, for instance, they don't believe. They don't believe, as many writers in the Hebrew Scriptures wrote, that we have a big dome over us and God is looking down on us through little peepholes called stars. There are laws in Leviticus that they don't want to try and enforce, such as if you curse your parents, you shall be executed. They create, this whole concept of the rapture is not in the Bible. There are contradictions all throughout the Gospels in the story of the life of Christ. Some Gospels have Christ being baptized by John the Baptist, and in Luke, John's already in prison. I mean, it you can't do it. I mean, the writers of the book of Genesis thought the earth was flat. I think that those are all tip-offs that there's something else behind this agenda.
Right.
And that it is very much in our interest as Americans who want to protect the pluralistic and open society that we live in, that we begin to peel back that religious veneer and uncover what it is they're actually seeking. I mean, look closely at the way they actually define basic terms of American democracy, such as liberty. You'll hear them talk a lot about liberty, and President Bush often speaks in code to them. But when they define liberty, it's the liberty of being liberated by Jesus Christ. It is, they've taken traditional concepts that everyone, that is a kind of common currency in this room, and distorted those concepts so that they may use the word, but they say one thing, it means one thing to us and another thing to their believers. And in many ways, the book that I'm writing on the Christian right is a kind of literary criticism of the religious right to give people another vocabulary and another language by which they can explain and understand this movement, which I think is very dangerous to our country.
You brought up this issue, and it's one of the questions from the audience, so I'm going to bring that up. When you were talking, Chris, up there in your opening remarks, you came across sort of as being completely so anti-war, and that you do not believe there's any... So the question really is there a just war? Do you believe in a just war? And I know you've said before in your writings that you're not a pacifist. So can you just talk a little bit about that idea, where you come from?
I just have problems with the term just war, because it appears to give a moral quality to war. I think that there are wars that are inevitable. I think that part of that mythology of war is being glorious and the way this war was sold to us, that it's, just a big video game. That disconnect from the reality of war allows us to fall into morasses such as the one we've fallen into Iraq. I think we always have to understand what war is, that war, when we carry out war, it's always tragic and it always is corrupting to the soul, even if it's done in what we could quote-unquote call a just cause.
Yeah. And I'm really troubled about these young people that are going to come back from Iraq, but we forget one of the things... Robert Bly pointed out in Iron John was that there have been more suicides from Vietnam vets than people died in the war, 54,000. Yeah. There have been more suicides. And, my brother used to drive a cab in the city, and he told me many times he'd pick these people up at night, late at night at bars, and he would drive, and they would weep the whole way back to their home and tell him about what they did in Vietnam. There's still people out there, 20% of our homeless are Vietnam vets. There's a whole generation that we haven't really dealt with very well, and the pain and suffering that goes with that. I was telling Cale earlier that I'd met a guy in Memphis, and I spent about half hour with him, and I just asked him at the end of it. I just said, "Were you in Vietnam?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "You were in combat?" He said, "Yeah." And it was just something. There was a look in his eyes. There's a look that some people get that just have seen a little bit too much, things that they shouldn't have seen. I just think that we fail to really understand how traumatizing these events are. A lot of these people are going to need a lot of help from us, from the community, in reintegrating them. One of the things that happened in Afghanistan was that after the Russians, people forget 1.5 million Afghan people died to 13,000 Russian soldiers. I mean, it's, pyrrhic victory. But one of the things that was done is that this, the CIA went there and supported this whole effort and gave them RPGs and, you know, all this weaponry. And when it was all over, there was no rebuilding. We just washed our hands. This country washed our hands of that event and left these people there to their own devices. You know, really traumatized people.
You know, Chris, you've written from the occupied territories and West Bank and Gaza, and you both have studied this issue quite a bit. Is this, and it's not a trick question, but is this really about religion? Is that a big part of that, of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, or is it, as a lot of people believe, simply a territorial issue?
I mean, I tend to agree with Amos Oz. It's a real estate issue. I do believe that religion has obviously some component, because the Jewish claim is a religious claim, even though a lot of Jews there, I mean, I think it's around 60 or 70% are considered secular Jews. But the Orthodox Jews don't even recognize, or at least one large branch of the Orthodox Jewish community doesn't recognize the state, because right. The Messiah has to bring about the formation. So,
well, real estate is huge. I mean, you know, Palestine was a Muslim country from the 7th century until 1948. But it's also an issue of repression. For those of us who have to work in places like Gaza and watch these people be stripped of their dignity and humiliated, the notion that, you know, take a list, draw up a list of the restrictions imposed on South African blacks during the apartheid regime, and draw up a list of the restrictions imposed on Palestinians, and it's pretty much the same. With the difference being that, as far as I know, the South Africans never sent attack helicopters and F-16s to bomb townships. What has happened, you know, when I first went to Gaza in 1988, Hamas was a non-entity. And what happened is that people have been reduced to, you know, subsistence living at this point would be kind. There's been a kind of Africanization of the Gaza Strip, with people struggling now to live on less than $2 a day. They can't move. They don't have, you know, potable water, often running water. It has just become a desperate, desperate situation. And where do people finally turn in that desperation? So is it religious? No. I mean, I think that you know, the wars that I've covered are usually manufactured wars. They're built out of terrible repression and terrible injustice and terrible abuse. But, of course, they oftentimes, especially when people are pushed to the extremes, that's all they have left to cling to. Unfortunately, they often cling to very apocalyptic visions. And that huge religious, social, and political center gets swept away.
What advice do you have? What would you tell people who about fighting these strains within our own religions, and how do we speak up? How do we affect anything? I'm not looking for practical advice particularly, but how to think about this maybe.
Well, I mean, I've said this many times, and I do believe it. Jonathan Swift said that we have just enough religion to hate one another and not enough to love one another. And I really believe that what we're suffering from in our religious traditions is a lack of religious understanding. I think when you really delve deeply into religion, you arrive at very similar centers. And primarily, you know, the Dhammapada, which is one of the earliest Buddhist texts, said that hate can never be fought with hate, but it must be fought with love. And this is an eternal truth. And there's a prophetic tradition that says none of you truly believes until you love for your fellow man and woman what you love for yourself. And one of the things about, I spoke about pseudo-speciation and Guantanamizing others, that the antidote for that is to recognize that we are one self. We come from one self. And the Quran says your creation was from one self and your resurrection will be of one self. And to see oneself in the other, you know, that this is a part of me. John Donne said, no man is an island, but each is a part of the main. That we are united in a common bond of humanity. And there are demons amongst us, and that is without a doubt. But they're not the norm. This is a a school, you know, that's celebrating Martin Luther King, and dreaming, moral imagination is very important, and teaching our children that it does not have to be this way. Every great movement of social change in human history came from people imagining something different than what was. And I think we have to teach our young people to imagine a world with social institutions that engender human flourishing. Because we've inherited social institutions, a lot of us don't even know where they came from. But we've inherited social institutions that have become very dystopic, they're very dysfunctional. And I really think that we as thinking citizens, we're not subjects, I mean, this, not yet. This country's based on citizenry. And citizenry is a responsibility. You know, we're answerable to what goes on. You know, we really are. And that's why we owe it to our children. I've got five children, and I owe it to my children not to become a cynic, not to become a pessimist. I can't do that. I can't do that for their sake and for all our children's sake, because they remind us of what's right in the world. And so I really, for our children's sake, we have to help them imagine something very different than what it is.
Chris, I wanted to just ask you the same question, but with one observation. In a lot of your writings and what you said tonight also, you seem to have a sense of despair, and that's one of the things that perhaps you can address. How do we overcome that?
I have despair. That?
I got pretty depressed reading your
book. I did too, actually.
I write a happy book. I have despair because I hear the radical fringes of my country and my society speak in hate talk. And having covered conflicts, I always know that you first get people to speak in the language of hate and violence before you get them to carry out acts of hate and violence. That language is not benign. And why is the radical fringe of the Christian right fighting hate crimes legislation? Because they know the things they say about secular humanists and gays and lesbians and Jews and Muslims and nominal Christians can often be defined as hate talk. And I think that that tolerance, as we spoke before, is extremely important, but there are moments, and I think we have reached a moment in our society when those of us who care about a tolerant society have to stand up and fight for it. And we have to say that there are things that you cannot say. You cannot call for the eradication of people of other faiths or other lifestyles or other ways of being. You cannot demonize them. You can't dehumanize them, which is really, of course, what they're doing. They're dehumanizing them. You know, there was a great quote by Dr. King, you know, and it's probably fitting that we end with his words. He said, "I can never be who I ought to be until you are who you ought to be, and you can never be who you ought to be until I am who I ought to be."
You've been listening to Does God Love War? A dialogue between Chris Hedges and Hamza Yousef, sponsored by the Zaytuna Institute, who provided this audio. The Zaytuna Institute was co-founded by one of the speakers we just heard, Hamza Yousef, in 1996. For more info on them, see zaytuna.org. That's zaytuna.org. Chris Hedges is a former war correspondent and the author of several books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and Losing Moses on the Freeway. His books are generally available in bookstores and on the web. You can contact this program and download MP3s and podcasts of this and previous shows from our archive at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.